I mean, if 2.5 million people spent 300 to 400 volunteer hours a year distributed in every congressional district, we would have full Medicare for all in 2 years or less. Why? Because the majority of the people want it. They don't like a kill or die healthcare system. Look at the prices of drugs these days. They don't like to be arbitrarily denied even when they have health insurance for corporate profits. So it's easier than we think. We really ought to have rallies. They just keep shouting. It's easier than we think to overcome this internalized sense of powerlessness that too many people have.
That's Ralph Nader, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Ralph Nader on citizen action. It's easier than we think. Part 1. Overcoming adversity alone is a tough road to hoe, but when you act with others, it's not as difficult. There is nothing like solidarity. There's unity and strength in numbers. Most movements have very modest beginnings. Take women's rights. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and a handful of other women met in Seneca Falls in upstate New York in 1848 to launch the women's rights movement. The odds were against them. The naysayers were out in force with their patronizing comments like, "Why bother? Don't get involved. Get back to the kitchen." Yet those women and the many who followed them were able to achieve much. Struggles continue. Today, the hashtag MeToo movement is challenging patriarchy by calling out men for sexual abuse and harassment and insisting on equal pay for equal work. Citizen action is easier than we think. Ralph Nader, a legendary figure, has spent a lifetime fighting on behalf of ordinary people. The Atlantic named him one of the 100 most influential figures in U.S. history. Founder of Public Citizen, he's a longtime advocate for consumer safety and workers' rights. He's an eloquent spokesperson for single-payer health care. He's the author of numerous books, including Breaking Through Power and To the Ramparts. I talked with him at the American Museum of Tort Law in his hometown of Winsted, Connecticut. There's so many things to talk about. Dickens came to mind. It's the best of times. It's the worst of times. It's the age of wisdom. It's the age of foolishness. But somehow that doesn't seem to be quite capturing the moment. It seems to be a lot more foolishness than wisdom and a lot more worst of times than best of times. What's your take on what's going on in the country, Ralph?
The relentless increase in corporate control of our elections, government, of democratic institutions. The media is very concentrated, as we know, in a few giant hands. We still have the thriving military-industrial complex. And more corporations are controlling people's money, you know, through credit cards, debit cards, payment systems, invading their privacy. So this, I would say, is the highest point of corporate control in a maturing corporate state. That is, they have so much control in Washington and state capitals that they turn the government against its own people through the legislatures and executive branch. And now they're getting their favorite appointments to the courts. So it's quite a strategic victory so far for corporations. And that's what they do. They strategically plan people's lives to get predictability, certainty, passivity. Who can deny that? I mean, just ask yourself from your own experience. They've strategically been planning the food we eat. Junk food, junk drink, huge obesity levels among children, direct marketing to children, circumventing parental authority and direct marketing. They certainly are trying to strategically plan our elections, our government policies, how public budgets are divided up, you know, for more F-13s and nuclear weapons and less renovation of public works and the public facilities in our domestic area. They're feeding empire, which eventually devours itself on the backs of the domestic deprivations. You can go through one strategic plan after another, and they do it. Just it's what comes naturally. That's how they maximize profits and corporate bonuses and stock prices. They don't have to have a conspiracy. If they had a conspiracy, it would be actually a brighter scene, because it means that there's some resistance that they have to conspire against. And so you go one after another. They're strategically planning our genetic inheritance. They have patented hundreds of gene sequences, not just flora and fauna, but human gene sequences. That's Monsanto and others. They've strategically planning a lot of our military and foreign policy. Empire feeds profits. They certainly are strategically planning our educational system, the commercializing education. They want all the children to be computer literate, but not civically literate. And so you just pick any sector of the economy, and they're there. And decades ago, they weren't all there. There were certain off limits to commercialism. When I was growing up, they maybe would try to sell us bubble gum. Now they try to sell kids everything. They tie them up with these fine print contracts, for heaven's sake, on Facebook. So that's what we have to confront. And elections are commercialized. And that's why the candidates, even some of the best ones, rarely use words like corporate welfare, corporate crime, corporate domination, corporate control. Even though back in 2000, Business Week polled the American people, and over 70% of them answered the question, do you think corporations have too much control of your lives? And they said yes. So in a general sense, people know who's running the show, the big boys. But they haven't organized to take advantage of the huge constitutional asset that people have, which starts with we the people, not we the corporation or we the Congress. To take over Congress first, they got the numbers, right? We have all kinds of left-right support for full Medicare for all, living wage, cracking down on corporate crime. This idea of red state, blue state, it doesn't quite operate when you go down to where people live, work and raise their families, David. I mean, they want clean air, they want clean water, they want adequate health care, they want good public schools and public transportation. And so that's why I wrote this book, Breaking Through Power. It's easier than we think. Because every major advance for justice in our country never took more than 1% or less of mobilized adults to reflect public opinion behind them and change Congress or state legislatures or government policy. And so that's a source of optimism, right? If you got 2.5 million adults scattered through 435 congressional districts, if you just need 2.5 million and you can recover our country, recover our government, recover our hopes and our dreams, is that too much to ask 1%? I mean, there are more than 1% of the people are bird watchers. Not nothing, don't have anything against bird watchers. So that's a long answer to an important question.
Well, Ursula Le Guin, the wonderful writer who passed away earlier this year, she said, we live in capitalism. Its power seems invincible. So did the divine rights of kings.
Yeah, it isn't really capitalism as we know it. I mean, my father and mother had a restaurant. That's capitalism. They had a bakery, a delicatessen, dining places. It's big corporate capitalism that's taking over. And they do everything to tie up small business in these franchise agreements or to disadvantage them, because the big guys get the tax breaks more than, say, the small businesses. And so corporate capitalism is literally destroying traditional small-scale capitalism. For example, Apple just announced $100 billion in stock buybacks. Who announced it? No more than 2 men at the top. $100 billion is 10 years budget of the Environmental Protection Agency. You want to make some comparisons, right? And whose money is it? It's the shareholders' money. They weren't asked for approval. They weren't asked for their advice. And this stock buyback doesn't really do much for stock values over time. It just increases the metrics for the executive compensation packages. Always, I think it's important now, it's always use the word big corporate capitalism. Violates the principles of capitalism, which is if you own something, you should have some control. Your shareholders have no control. That if you can't meet market demand, you accept the verdict of the market. You don't go to Washington like the big banks go for a bailout, right? Or if you don't like small businesses challenging you, you're supposed to play fair. You're not supposed to monopolize. You're not supposed to get government to disadvantage small business or get bailed out big business. So it's very important the language we use. This business of using words like inequality, what do they mean? Inequality means exploiting workers. Why don't the Democrats say that? Austerity means taking small taxpayer dollars and giving it to the next 10 nuclear submarines or the next 10 military ventures instead of renovating our schools and building clinics and improving our public transit and highways and bridges and courthouses. So it's very important the language we use.
Well, the traditional corporations that we knew, U.S. Steel, GM, Sears, yeah. Westinghouse, they've been replaced by Apple, yeah. Facebook, Google, etc. How have their practices evolved? How is this capitalism different from the predecessors?
Well, you've got to hand it to the corporate capitalists. They're quite ingenious and innovative. And someone once said about Facebook, when you, the customer, the user, when you get something free, watch out because you become the product. And the product is all that personal information you give Facebook, which goes anywhere in the world now to very nefarious users, not just to above board advertisers, without your control. So the question is, why have we done this? Why don't we charge for our personal information? Because we're not organized. And Facebook's organized to the teeth, and they know our weak points, especially young people. And they know how to put us in touch with one another and gossip and text message and befriend and put photographs up there, right? So they know how to get us at the most emotional, personal level without our suddenly realizing that we're allowing them to invade ourself. And now it's becoming more and more corrosive, right? Recent admissions by the apologist-in-chief, Zuckerman, who apologizes every day for breakfast and then keeps doing what he says he's not going to want to do anymore.
There's been historically a problem with progressives in eating themselves,
yeah.
Kind of a circular firing squad. And there was the great Canadian songwriter, Leonard Cohen, he wrote, "Ring the bells that can still ring, forget your perfect offering. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light goes in." How do we overcome those sectarian differences and devotion to purity? Yeah. I can't vote, you know, for this candidate because
well,
she did this.
You start with people's perceived necessities, and then you go to their perceived sense of fair play. And then you go to their perceived sense of injustice, and suddenly red state, blue state disappears. Because when I talk to very conservative people in Alabama and Mississippi and Georgia, guess what? They bleed too when there are dangerous cars, when there's toxic air pollution, when they get ripped off by the credit card companies or the insurance companies or the banks. You see, so it's what semanticists call get down the abstraction ladder, where people work, raise their families, and live. And then suddenly you have an unbeatable political coalition of conservative liberal workers, conservative liberal consumers, conservative liberal people who want a safe environment, conservative liberal taxpayers who don't want their taxes to go to subsidize and bail out big business and Wall Street. And when you have all that, David, guess what? You have conservative liberal voters locking arms. And you know, some of the biggest verdicts in our courts come from the most conservative areas of the country. They don't come from Massachusetts or New York. They come from Beaumont, Texas, or southern Alabama before they changed the laws, corporate lobbyists. Why? Because these people know what the boot of the cotton plantations were on them, of corporations now, where they have to bail out everything. And they resent it. They resent the way they're treated. And when they're in that jury box, they give an adequate award and they give punitive damages. So once we get rid of this divide and rule strategy, which goes back thousands of years, right? That's how the few control the many. And show that there are divisions over reproductive rights, gun control, but far more unifying transformations and changes in our country for a more just society that get left-right support. You get left-right support on full Medicare for all, and it organizes itself in every congressional district. It's unstoppable. You'll see the Congress turn like this. Politicians are like corporations. When they see power they can't beat or co-opt, they are very expedient. They're very opportunistic because they want to stay where they are.
Monsanto was just slapped with a $300 million fine for using glyphosate. They're going to fight it, but that's one example, again, of corporate malpractice being adjudicated in a San Francisco court in this case.
And other ingredients in the weed killer besides glyphosate. Yeah. Maybe that's why they decided to sell out to the giant German company, Bayer. Monsanto is now owned by Bayer.
And according to the Environmental Protection Group, EPG, they just came out with a report saying that breakfast cereals, energy bars also contain traces of glyphosate, which they regard as a carcinogen.
Well, you know, toxic chemicals in particular know no boundaries, whether they're borders or where people live. Although where people live in poor areas, they often get more toxic. So that's where a lot of the polluting industries locate. They don't locate in Belmont, Massachusetts, or Scarsdale, New York.
Let's swing back to Apple again. $1 trillion value now. Its founder, Steve Jobs, his father was a Syrian immigrant, yes. Abdul Fattah al-Jandali from Homs, Syria. It's kind of ironic that there's that element with the current wave of xenophobia and anti-immigrant grandstanding by the administration.
Well, immigrants, you know, they tend to be very anxious about whether they're going to succeed when they come. And so they tend to be very entrepreneurial and very hardworking, given where they fled from, right? So they have obviously built a lot of our economy and invented a lot of our products and led in the professions. Don't you know that cartoon? It shows a Native American with a feather saying, "You don't like immigrants? Tell me when you're going to leave." Now this is all hyped up. You know, Trump hyped this immigration thing up with lies, like they're coming over and they're criminals and rapists and, you know, the law.
Voting in the millions.
Yeah, voting fraudulent in the millions. Mm. And, you know, you get Fox News reporting this and others again and again and all the tweets that he puts out. You can create an issue out of nothing. I mean, there are obviously border issues. You know, you have to secure your borders from pollution, from smuggling, from people who don't have the right papers, because the Wall Street Journal, you know, really likes open borders because they want wages to be driven down. So it's not like, you know, you can have open borders, but you can have compassionate borders, and you can have people who want to come for a period of time and do work that Americans don't want to do work. But if you raise the minimum wage, you'd have less of a undocumented immigration problem. If we had a decent foreign policy and didn't support all the vicious dictators in Central America and Mexico, pulverizing the people and brutalizing them, what do you think they're going to do? They're going to look north and flee to save their families. You know, who wouldn't do that? It really starts with our foreign policy. I think Chomsky talked about that a lot in your programs.
Your parents are immigrants from Lebanon, right?
Yes.
What were their circumstances?
Well, my father was a young man. He came here at age 19. And there weren't any jobs there. It was the Ottoman Empire. And so he wanted to support his family, his siblings and his mother. his father passed away, immigrating to Brazil. It's all economic opportunity. My mother was a teacher, and as my father said in his restaurant, which was like a town meeting every day, one small businessman on the street said, at Nader's for a nickel, you got a cup of coffee and 10 minutes of politics. So when sometimes the people sitting at the counter chided him for his outspoken views, he said, you're going to lose business, Mr. Nader, talking so controversially. He said, really? Let me tell you something. When I sailed past the Statue of Liberty, I took it seriously. Don't you? You can see where we come from, David.
Well, I kind of share that background. My parents fled from genocide of the Armenians. Yes. They met in Beirut in an arranged marriage and came to New York. He opened a grocery store 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. And we lived upstairs, and the grocery store was downstairs.
Imagine
if we were separated from our parents, as the current administration has a pronounced and announced policy of inflicting pain on people. It's sadistic, nothing
less. Well, imagine if Trump's policies, he wants to only admit skilled immigrants, like doctors, engineers, computer designers, leaving out everyone else. Where would we have been? Where would millions and tens of millions of Americans have been? He wouldn't be there, because his grandfather came from Germany. He wasn't exactly skilled. But then hypocrisy is in Donald Trump's DNA, right?
Well, in certain respects, I mean, Trump's a pretty easy target. I mean, it's almost like shooting fish in a barrel.
Except he gets away with everything. You know, if he needs a bestseller, he's got one. All he has to do is write a book called Getting Away with Everything, so far.
But in terms of, you know, what generated Trump and what he represents, talk about that rather than this outrageous man who makes racist and misogynistic comments.
Well, what does he represent? He's a failed serial gambling czar who jumped ship with money and left his creditors, employees, consumers, workers, you know.
But you have 90% of Republicans who still support Trump. How do you account for that?
It's called the Democratic Party. It's called Hillary Clinton. So many people voted for Trump who hated Hillary Clinton. 90% of the Republicans is, you know, less than 35% of the voters to begin with. But when you don't see an alternative, you go with the guy who presumably speaks to your prejudices and lies in an optimistic way. Well, I once had a Trump voter say to me, and I said, why are you voting for Trump? I mean, you're intelligent. Just because you're a redneck doesn't mean you're stupid. You've got to really shake people up a bit. And he said, I'll tell you why. Because, first, he looks like us. Remember Trump, his last slogan before he's elected? He said to his potential voters, this is our last chance. You know what that meant. Second, the guy had a sense of humor. He said, he lies all the time, but then all politicians lie. But I like Trump. He lies optimistically. You know, everything is rosy. The economy's terrific. You know, we're going to settle the North Korean thing. We're going to make America great again. Remember, he was not elected president. He was selected by the Electoral College. Hillary Clinton, for all her foibles, Hawk Hillary, Wall Street Hillary, beat him by 3 million votes. We have this crazy system, antiquated system we have to get rid of, where you can come in second running for president, as George W. Bush did to Gore, and you become president. Now, there is a movement to get rid of the Electoral College called NationalPopularVote.com. It started by a businessman who was in the computer industry. He sold out, started a foundation, Steve Silverstein, hired 7 people, and he's got like a whole number of states to pass laws, from California to New York, which says if we reach 270 electoral votes, we will throw our electoral votes to whoever wins the popular vote. And they're already up to 172. Connecticut was the last state to join. You think the Democratic Party would support this? I mean, they only lost two presidential elections, which put George W. Bush in charge and Donald Trump in charge, and they're still dialing for Wall Street money and not supporting this effort.
Well, do you think those capitalist corporations that you were describing earlier are enthusiastic or feel very good about Trump's global economic policies of tariffs?
They're nervous. So far, he's done things they like. He's cut corporate taxes. He's cut the taxes of the rich. It's a far bigger tax cut than you can ever believe in terms of profits stored abroad, coming back. You got 8 years. You pay a trivial amount of tax. You can continue to send money abroad to tax havens like Luxembourg, Ireland, these islands. So they like that. Deregulation, they like that, even though most regulations are so out of date that they're hardly got any bite to them. So they like that. They love the huge military budget expansion. I mean, he gave the Pentagon $80 billion they weren't even asking for. They're going to waste it. He didn't even give the Coast Guard an adequate budget, which is in the Department of Homeland Security. But the Coast Guard doesn't shoot people up. He gives it to the generals, who must have been delighted. But so was Lockheed, so was Grumman, so was Raytheon, so was General Dynamics. So far they like this, okay? However, he is unpredictable. They don't like unpredictable politicians. They don't want to get into a war that will mess up the stock market and the banking system. And so they got their fingers crossed. So far, he's massaged their wildest dreams of avarice. However, they're worried about his instability. And they're worried about people around him that are total crazed warmongers, like John Bolton, the National Security Advisor in the White House, and the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. It's interesting. Bolton graduates from Yale Law School, and he pushes stuff that's totally illegal, domestically, constitutionally, and international law. Pompeo does the same thing, and he's a graduate of the Harvard Law School. You don't think the law schools are a problem?
You're listening to Ralph Nader on Citizen Action. It's easier than we think. Part one of a special two-part program. This is Independent Alternative Radio. The midterm elections are coming up, and it's become almost a cliche in media reporting the line that this is the most important election in U.S. history. How do you see things evolving, particularly in terms of what happened in New York with the election of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her victory over an entrenched Democratic incumbent, Joe Crowley?
First of all, let's not make huge things out of small victories. Progressives exaggerate the smallest victories because they don't have anything else. You got Queens, the district. You got a multi-ethnic district. You got a very low turnout. You got a tremendously energetic candidate taking on Joe Crowley, who was on his way to become maybe Speaker of the House. And she won with a very small turnout. It's fine that she won, right? And he congratulated her. But let's see if it happens in Arizona with a progressive Democrat member of Congress who worked on my 2000 campaign, by the way, is challenging the Republican nominee to take the spot of Senator Flake, who's retiring. I don't see yet the so-called blue wave. They certainly are making the elections closer than they were in 2016 and 2014. But the Democrats never lose an opportunity to lose. And they are not using the right language. They are not talking specifically. And so people don't believe them. When you hear the Democrats say they're for a higher minimum wage, people say, really? You've been saying that for years. How high? Have you really pushed it in Congress? They don't tell them how high. They haven't pushed it in Congress. So why should people believe them? So the Democrats have a real authenticity problem, although there are some insurgent Democrats that are really authentic. And that's a bright spot. But it's not like they aren't being imposed by the entrenched Democrats in the Democratic National Committee and the bureaucracy. In the primaries, the National Democratic Party opposed the insurgents, including the ones who won the primary. They supported the entrenched choices that they picked.
One of the focuses of the Republicans in 2016 was the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
They were constantly hammering on that, and elections have consequences. Witness the appointment of Gorsuch, which witnessed the appointment of Kavanaugh. So elections have enormous consequences, but the Democrats did not talk about the Supreme Court as an important issue, and to the religious right, in particular, the evangelical base, it's a critical issue.
Of course it is, because once you get a nominee confirmed by the Senate, you are electing a judicial dictator for life. It's very hard to impeach the Supreme Court justice. And they have enormous power, and the conservative justices, contrary to their propaganda, are judicial activists like you've never seen. Look at Citizens United giving corporations unlimited license to spend unlimited money for or against candidates at local, state, and national offices. The only time it seems the Democrats invoke the Supreme Court is when they want to fight off the Green Party or third parties. I mean, here's a Republican Party that doesn't even pay a penalty for trying to block people from voting. There is no Western country that so blocks people from voting and so blocks challenging third-party and independent candidates from getting on the ballot, and they're both connected. You can't have a meaningful vote without meaningful competition for candidates. But look at the system we have now. It's such a razor-edge system. John Kerry would have won the election in 2004 with 100,000 more votes in Ohio. Everything else the same. Then there would not have been two nominations to the Supreme Court by George W. Bush. Donald Trump is selected by the Electoral College. He loses the popular vote. He becomes president, and he's about to get two more Supreme Court justices. In 2016, there were three senators for every one Democrat senator up for re-election. They should have won the Senate handily. If they had just won two seats, you wouldn't have heard of Judge Gorsuch becoming Justice Gorsuch, and you wouldn't have heard of Brett Kavanaugh on his way to becoming Associate Justice, although I think he could be stopped. So that's where we're at. The Democratic Party cannot defend our nation from the worst Republican Party in history. Senator Howard Taft, Teddy Roosevelt, Dwight Eisenhower would have been appalled. You have the most corrupt, ignorant, Wall Street indentured, warmongering, corporatist, pro-corporate welfare, anti-worker, anti-consumer, anti-environmentalist, openly, brazenly, the worst Republican Party since it was created in 1854, and the Democrats can't landslide it at the legislative and congressional level? So whenever we go after Trump and the Republicans, ask yourself who put him in office.
Would you favor term limits for Supreme Court justices?
Yes. I would favor 12 years and out, and that's enough. In fact, the appointment system is now resulting in such corporatist judges that are basically rendering decision after decision, 5-4, to entrench the corporate state. They think corporations are people and that they have privileges and immunities over people that are constitutional. So they're always voting for these corporations. And I don't think that would be the case if they were elected, especially if we had campaign finance reform for judicial elections and legislative elections.
And the American Civil Liberties Union also believes that corporations are people. You've written about that.
Yeah, well,
in a letter
the American Civil Liberties Union, thank goodness for it, has saved our civil liberties again and again in court cases as one Achilles heel. It thinks corporations should have all the rights that human beings have under our Constitution, including free speech. So it supported the notorious Citizens United case with an amicus brief and still has not regretted it, and it has supported the tobacco industry ads that induce lung cancer and other human diseases, and they still won't recant. So I wrapped their knuckles in a letter to the New York Times, but more should be made of that. They've had an internal debate about this since the 1970s, the board of the ACLU. They always come out, corporations have to be given the same rights as people. Ask me a tough question, will you?
Gerrymandering.
Well, first of all, Democrats hate Republican gerrymandering when the Republicans control the state house and the legislature. And Republicans hate Democrat gerrymandering when the shoe's on the other foot. So who's responsible for gerrymandering? Which is basically putting a system in where the politicians pick their voters. How about that for a somersault? Instead of the people picking the politicians. And so I blame both parties. However, having said that, we don't want to use that as too big an excuse for the Democratic Party, because, you know, the Republicans control the majority of state legislatures and governorships now, so they can gerrymander more. Because there are 125 million people who are over the age of 18 and they didn't vote in 2016 and 2014. So Democrats have a lot of people that can get out to vote. You know, the Democratic issues poll much better than the Republican issues. They're more majoritarian issues. Like the Democrats are for minimum wage and Medicare, and the Republicans don't say that. They are against the principle of minimum wage, never mind freezing it $7.25 an hour federally. It's higher in some states. So we do need to get rid of gerrymandering. The way to do it is the way California has now done it, Iowa has done it years ago. You create a nonpartisan civil service commission to carve up the districts so they don't look like squiggly districts, you know, pick Republicans and Democrats. And so that's it. Now, so it's up to the Supreme Court, and they're getting a little closer to declaring some partisan, what they call partisan, raw, brazen gerrymandering, unconstitutional.
How would you talk to Christian evangelicals who are focused laser-like on issues like abortion and gay marriage? Those are the things that matter to them, cultural issues.
I would say let it matter to you. But I would also counsel you to observe in all other areas of human and animal and environmental life the golden rule. If you observe that and vote according to the golden rule, we won't be so troubled with your heartfelt decisions on other issues that you think are deeply embedded in your moral core, because you will not be electing corporatists, and you will not be turning our country over to global corporations who have no allegiance to our country other than to empty out the jobs and leave hollow communities and ship their profits and labor abroad.
Levitsky and Ziblatt are two Harvard University professors. They have a book out called How Democracies Die, in which they write, "We think of democracies as dying at the hands of men with guns, but more often they die at the hands of elected leaders who maintain a veneer of democracy." Then they went on to say that Trump's election was in fact a step toward authoritarianism. The erosion began long before Trump, and the problems will outlast him. So contextualize Trump, along with people like Modi in India, Erdogan in Turkey, Orban in Hungary, Zeman in the Czech Republic.
How about Netanyahu?
Netanyahu in Israel, that have come to power, Duterte in the Philippines, who have come to power through the ballot box, through legal means.
Well, first, the Harvard professors don't go far enough. They said it starts with elected officials, right? No. The drip-drip decay of democracy starts with us, the voters, the people who don't vote, the people who don't cast an informed vote, the people who sneer at the word politics as if it's a dirty word. I mean, if millions of Americans think politics is a dirty word, why are they so surprised when they get dirty politics? So why do we let ourselves off? We're the ones who give the senators and representatives our sovereign power, which they turn and sell to Wall Street and use it against us. So we have no responsibility? It's like Pogo. Remember that? They look in the mirror. We've seen the enemy and it's us. And people say, oh, that's politically incorrect. You don't want to blame the victim. Let me tell you something. Every American in this country who doesn't vote, or who is a slogan voter, doesn't attend town meetings, can't be bothered to go to any rallies for things that they believe in, cannot be bothered to ask their children what they learned in school today, other than memorizing myths and learning how to be powerless. Do they learn about civic duty? Do they learn about jury duty? Do they learn about the law of wrongful injury? Now that we're in the American Museum of Tort Law, that's what tort law is. Every time people make those decisions, every time people say, I can't be bothered to go down to the town meeting or the neighborhood meeting of citizens or the zoning commission or the health department hearing, they are the drip, drip, drip decay of our democratic society.
You denounce in your book about the corporate-dominated two-party tyranny. Is it tyrannical?
Of course. Democracy means nothing if it doesn't mean competitive elections. If you can't challenge the two parties entrenched in an electoral process because the electoral ballot access laws are horrifically difficult to surmount, short deadlines, huge numbers of petitions, they can invalidate the petitions, you know, arbitrarily. If you don't get on the debate, so people even know you're running, if money disadvantages your campaign, if people grow up thinking that they only have two choices, Republican or Democrat, and they learn this, by the way, in Scholastic magazine in middle school. They have Republican candidate, Democratic candidate, then they have a blank face. One mother complained to me from North Dakota saying, my 9-year-old came and said, I want to vote for Ralph Nader, Mama, but I don't see his picture in the Scholastic magazine. So they start early on, you see. So people don't want to vote for people who can't win. You know the phrase? You know, I don't want to waste my vote, throw away my vote. So we got to change the voting laws, universal voting, and make it very easy to get on the ballot. It's much easier to get on the ballot in Canada and Western countries. I said once it was harder to get on a ballot in North Carolina than to get on a ballot of 8 European countries.
I thought you were going to say North Korea. Well, there's some would say a whiff of fascism in the air. I use that term gingerly because it's sometimes promiscuously invoked. But, you know, FDR said, the liberty of a democracy is not safe if the people tolerate the growth of private power to the point where it becomes stronger than than the democratic state itself. That, in essence, FDR said, is fascism.
That was in a message to Congress in 1938, before World War II. And that's what it is. Fascism is defined as the merger of big business and government. So big business not only has power over the private economy, but it has the power of government to entrench itself. And that usually brings violation of civil liberties, suppression of free speech, manipulation of elections to a point where they shouldn't even bear that description, and the concentration of power in the hands of the few against the many, and the concentration of wealth and income.
And would you include the relentless attack on the media and journalism, the enemy of the people?
Yes, of course. I mean, you attack any potential challenging point in the society. So you attack minorities because they don't go along and they're scapegoated, which is what Hitler did, obviously. The fascist corporate state can brook nobody challenge. So always goes to the extreme. because it thinks, oh, you just let these people get a foot in the door. We can't even allow that.
I mean, individual journalists have been called out by the president in this regime of tweets that we live under, putting them in physical danger.
Yes.
I mean, if you see these rallies, they have a whiff of Nuremberg to them.
I can see a rally by Trump after the Mueller investigation subpoenas him and he creates a constitutional crisis. I can see a rallies by Trump where he so incites the people in the arena and then points to the reporters and then some people jump up and attack physically the reporters and injure them, that Trump will be sued under the law of torts for incitement to violence. And while presidents are above the law when it comes to military and foreign policy, and they can do terrible things and get away with it, they cannot escape the law of torts and the street criminal law. For example, Trump can give the store away to the big banks illegally and get away with it. But if he goes out and robs the bank opposite the White House, he will be prosecuted. And the same is true for Clinton, who was subjected to the tort law, and he lied under oath and was stripped of his right to practice law in Arkansas and was impeached, acquitted in the Senate. So if I was a legal advisor to Donald Trump, I'd say, you better cool it, Donald. You're going to be sued by journalists for major media if you are inciting these people. And he points to the reporters by name.
Where do you see the Mueller investigation going? Do you think there will be more indictments coming down?
Yes, because a lot of the indictments are on run-of-the-mill crimes, tax violations, bribes. And so there will be indictments, and Mueller's strategy is that he's got a slam-dunk impeachable case against Trump for obstruction of justice. But you need to have convictions. You have to obstruct justice against not just charges of crimes by other people, his coterie, his campaign manager, and others. And so that's why he's going at the lower level, so he gets a number of convictions, and then he can go after Trump for obstruction of justice, which was, by the way, what brought Nixon down. It wasn't anything other than obstructing justice in the Watergate break-in.
Yeah, it wasn't the secret bombing of Cambodia, for example. No.
That's where presidents are above the law. They are judge, jury, prosecutor, executioners, and cover-uppers. And all recent presidents have expanded that authority all over the world and gotten away with it. Democrat and Republican.
What about the focus on Russia meddling in our elections? Is this a distraction or is this something concrete that should be paid attention to?
It is concrete, but first of all, we've not only meddled for over 60 years in other countries' elections, we've overthrown democratically elected leaders from Iran to Central America, to Guatemala. And it's still going on. We have a foreign policy, and one of its parts is meddling in elections. Look what we did in Honduras under Obama and in Ukraine. So we meddle in elections. So now we don't like it when the Russians are meddling. And so they did meddle. I don't know whether it changed many votes, but they got into social media. They tried to scare people. They favored one side over another. I think they wanted Trump over Hillary, because Hillary was itching for a fight, you know, with Putin, very aggressive against Russia. And so, yes, it's going to get worse here, but we have more serious meddlers. We have people meddling in software in elections, right? We have people meddling in vote counts, domestic people, domestic interests. So, yeah, it's going to get worse, and there are going to be other countries doing it to us because now they know the tools of social media, right? And hacking is a universal opportunity for anybody.
In August 1964, to change the topic a little bit, 14,000 retirees went to the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City lobbying for Medicare. within months that bill was signed, enacted into law, actually in Independence, Missouri, in the presence of Harry Truman, because he tried to get a national health insurance plan in the late 40s and it didn't succeed.
Yeah.
What can we learn about that successful struggle to get Medicare with the current battles?
What can we learn? It's easier than we think. I mean, if 2.5 million people spent 300 to 400 volunteer hours a year distributed in every congressional district, we would have full Medicare for all in 2 years or less. Why? Because the majority of the people want it. They don't like a kill or die healthcare system. Look at the prices of drugs these days. They don't like to be arbitrarily denied even when they have health insurance for corporate profits. So it's easier than we think. We really ought to have rallies. They just keep shouting, it's easier than we think, to overcome this internalized sense of powerlessness that too many people have. It also makes them comfortable. You know, when people make excuses for themselves as citizens, I can spend more time watching TV. I don't want to be too harsh on a lot of people, because a lot of people do have two jobs. They're single moms. They have to take care of ailing parents. They really often can't break away and go down to a town meeting. But I know in the disability rights movement, which I was a part of, David, years ago, we had seriously disabled people get on the phone and push their legislators. And if they can do it, everyone should be able to do it, with certain exceptions for certain family crisis or economic crisis personally. So it's easier than we think. I look for a million people to surround Congress when it's in session, not on a weekend, demanding in one massive bellow for full Medicare for all, free choice of doctor and hospital, much less expensive, with better outcomes and lives saved. You don't think that would change it? Right now, the members of Congress, all 535 of them, look around and all they see are drug company lobbyists with their checkbooks, hospital chain lobbyists with their checkbooks.
Well, maybe we can take a little inspiration from what happened in this tiny landlocked Republic of Armenia in April and May, when literally the entire population went out in the streets, closed down government ministries, officials couldn't get to their offices, and overthrew an entrenched oligarchy that had been in power for decades, a corrupt regime, non-violently.
Yes.
And that happened in Armenia. It was barely reported on here in the United States.
Well, you make a very good point. And Armenia's population is smaller than the state of Connecticut. And how about this incredible breakthrough between Ethiopia and Eritrea, where this 41-year-old prime minister now of Ethiopia, a marvelous progressive person, has basically said to the dictatorship of Eritrea, enough bloodshed over desert land. Enough. We're going to have peace. And the population just rose in applause and acclaim. Where is that on progressive radio? So all over the last 100 years, as Coleman McCarthy, who tries to get peace studies in high schools and colleges and has had a lot of success, he says there are a lot of examples where waging peace has worked, but 99% of the coverage is on war.
You were just listening to Ralph Nader on Citizen Action, It's Easier Than We Think, part one of a special two-part program. I talked with him in Winsted, Connecticut. Ralph Nader, a legendary figure, has spent a lifetime fighting on behalf of ordinary people. Life magazine ranks him as one of the most influential Americans of the 20th century. He rose to fame in the 1960s when he took on General Motors and its unsafe Corvair car. His 1965 book, Unsafe at Any Speed, not only created a sensation, but was also instrumental in the enactment of the Motor Vehicle Safety Act. He has exposed the misdeeds of the corporate sector as well as the political system. He's the author of numerous books, including Breaking Through Power and To the Ramparts. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Noam Chomsky, Arun Gupta, Tariq Ali, Vandana Shiva, Jeremy Scahill, and Abby Martin. We also have a series of Ralph Nader programs. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Charlene Lavoie. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.